Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Great Creators early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. From Built It Productions, it's The Great Creators. Conversations about creativity with some of the most celebrated actors, musicians, and performers of our time. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, actor, director, screenwriter, and comedian Ike Barinholtz.
I don't think there's anyone in comedy who just is like, I've always killed. It's just weird. I think you just have to know that, and to know that failure is not like the end of the world.
Ike Barinholtz is one of those actors that you see in a movie and you say, oh, he's in everything. And even though he's not always the star, he's been a big part of the comedy scene since the early 2000s. Ike's had a supporting role in tons of hit comedies, including The Mindy Project, Neighbors, Blockers, Sisters, and The After Party. He got a start in his early 20s in Chicago doing stand-up and improv, and quickly ended up on the cast of Mad TV. But after some early struggles to land more roles, Ike realized it might not happen for him as an actor. And for many years, he focused his time on trying to become a writer. In this episode of the show, you'll hear how Ike worked as a busboy at Second City, where he learned from legends like Tina Fey and Rachel Dratch and Jordan Peele and Seth Meyers. He talks about moving to L.A., hoping to make it big and failing pretty hard. At one point, he couldn't even get the role of an onion in a Quiznos commercial. You'll also hear how Ike got cast on Mad TV, and after 5 years of success, what it was like to be told he wasn't coming back. And how after a long and painful stretch without getting any parts, Ike decided to pivot to screenwriting, and how that opened a door to collaborating with Mindy Kaling and unexpectedly reviving his acting career. That's all coming up after a quick break.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
When you choose Organic Valley, not only will you be enjoying great tasting dairy, you'll help to save over 1,600 small organic family farms who are protecting over 400,000 acres of organic farmland and all the plants and animals that call it home. This is dairy you can feel good about. It's great tasting, high quality organic dairy, ethically sourced from small organic family farms. To find Organic Valley Dairy near you, visit ov.coop. That's ov.coop.
For the past several decades, Chicago is where some of the best comedians in America got their start. Stephen Colbert, Seth Meyers, Tina Fey, Jason Sudeikis, Rachel Dratch, and so many others were doing stand-up and improv at Chicago theaters like The Annoyance and Second City. And Ike Barinholtz, he grew up there, right in the thick of all of this in the 80s and 90s. But early on, comedy wasn't on Ike's mind at all. Actually, he saw himself becoming a politician.
You know, it's funny, growing up in Chicago at that time, the people you looked up to, at least I did, were athletes, Chicago Cubs specifically.
Yeah.
This was even like pre-Michael Jordan when I first got
You grew up, this is when the Bears went to the Super Bowl.
Oh, yeah.
And,
yeah.
Yeah, this is a great time. You had Ryan Sandberg on the Cubs.
Oh, Rhino, Leon Durham. Just a great time to be a kid in Chicago. And my father was friends with some kind of local politicians. One guy in particular was a committeeman of the 46th Ward. And so on election day, we would go out, we would go to stop by the campaign offices, and I was struck by two things. I was struck by, A, how politicians talk, and how what they are selling you, whether or not they're being honest, is irrelevant. What they're trying to tell people is they want to help them. And watching the reaction between a politician and you know, a voter, I just was very... I thought it looked cool and you could help people maybe. And the other thing was the food at the campaign offices. It was just people were bringing by donuts. They were bringing by all kinds of like Polish pastries and stuff. But anyways, it was just very intoxicating. And I just kind of was thinking, oh man, I would love to do that. Be a senator from Illinois. Can you imagine how much fun that would be? Or the mayor of Chicago. And so that was kind of what I always thought where I thought I would end up.
I mean, there's an element. There are parallels, right? There's an element of performance in politics for sure. But you didn't grow up in we've had people on the show who are children of actors or who got into theater at age five and were the stars of their high school drama programs. You were not any of that, right? Not even the drama program in high school.
Not even. I remember. When I was a junior, I was like, I'm going to audition for the play. What the heck? It was Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
And I was like, my friends are doing it. It'll be fun. And I remember I worked really hard on the audition. I auditioned to play the lion. And I got cast as Uncle Henry, which everyone agrees.
That's a small role.
It's the worst part in the whole play. he's pretty much worthless. He has one or two lines. Like, Dorothy, we were worried about you. And I remember, this is awful. I spent all night working on this audition. I came in, I sang in front of people, and then they're like, you're going to be the loser uncle. So I wasn't feeling that was where I was going to end up, but I also did my thing I loved doing was watching movies. Like, I loved watching movies and TV shows, especially with my friends. We were not cool guys in high school. Instead, some cool guys would go to parties and, go on dates. We would just go to each other's house and just watch three movies.
Yeah.
And so I loved that world. I would read books about it, but I didn't quite see myself moving into it until I was late in my teens.
Yeah. And as a high school kid, would you have been described as funny or the class clown or a guy who's always telling jokes? Do you think kids would have described you that way?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I it's so funny. All my friends, we were all clowns, All the guys, all the girls, everyone was just constantly laughing. But I would say I was the one who would have the funny response to the speaker in the assembly. Or I was the one when we had to come up with a senior prank that would be like, oh, what if we just, got a bunch of chickens and let them loose in the school. So I would say that when my high school classmates found out I was going into comedy, that none of them were surprised, I would say.
Yeah. You went off to Boston University, with no intention of, again, doing theater or drama or acting or comedy, and you lasted a year. You dropped out. What happened?
I went to BU, and I think I went in knowing that it might not last, just because I was not in BU has the College of Liberal Arts. It has the engineering school, journalism school, I think. But then if you had decent boards and bad grades, they had this thing called CGS, which was you do a year or two in this, and then you get to finish the last 2 years of whatever college you want. So I wasn't in a great program, but that didn't really matter. Even if I was in one of the other programs, I got there, and I think first of all, just the freedom kind of overtook me a little bit. The freedom to do whatever you want. Not that my parents were strict, but just it was the first time where I was like, yeah, I could go to class or I could watch four movies today. And there's more often than not, I would choose that. So I think probably a couple months in there, I at least in my head came to the realization that I was not coming back here. Which meant that the door for politics was probably closed. But I knew there was something else.
Not necessarily. I mean, there's plenty of...
Well, now, yeah.
I mean, look at Congress today.
Oh, my God. please. I would be the president pro tempore of the Senate right now compared to some of these folks. But I think back then, it was very much kind of like you had to kind of do the four-year college and you had to.
Sure.
And so, I think I was probably bummed. My parents were certainly bummed. I wasn't very forthright with them about what was happening. So then, I came back to Chicago after Boston. I was like, I'm going to come back to Chicago. And I knew that I had some kind of showbiz bug coming back from BU. just because some of the movies I was watching, and specifically some of the TV shows I was watching, really kind of blew me away. It's so funny. I remember this one night we were at someone's dorm and they had cable and they had HBO, and it was the first episode of Mr. Show, which I don't know if you've seen Mr. Show with Bob Odenkirk and David Cross. Mm-hmm. Like, it's, you know, arguably the best sketch show ever. And it blew me away. Like, I couldn't believe there could be things that funny. And it felt also like it was stuff that, like, it was like ideas and stuff that I was like, I could do that, you know? So that was that was an early thing where I was like, oh, comedy. And it was really coming back to Chicago, and my dad randomly had a friend whose brother was this kind of big improviser in Chicago. And he was like, hey, I'm going to take you to this theater's, I think it was the Improv Olympics 10th anniversary. And I went, and that was it. That was like the moment
that
where
show.
I was like, that specific show, the specific line from Tim Meadows that made me laugh so hard that I was like, I want to be doing this. Like, these are just...
Do you remember who, besides Tim Meadows, who was in that show that you saw?
Yeah, Amy Poehler, Adam McKay. I mean, you know, just all these legends. Kevin Dorff, I think Tina Fey was there. Chris Farley had sent in a video because he was still on SNL. It was just like...
Wow.
It was just incredible. And that...
This is like 96. So this is before, obviously, these people were hugely famous. They were improv actors.
They were improv actors, and we went to high school right down the street from Second City, so we would see them. We would go to Mr. G's and get hot dogs, and we would see, like, we didn't know who they were, but it was Chris Farley and Tim Meadows, like, early on, before they even went to SNL. And so going and seeing these people do this art form that I had really never seen before, it just felt like it could be accessible to me, and I was laughing so hard that I was like, I want to do this.
Because you were, I mean, from what I understand, when you dropped out of college, like, to make money, you got a job working for the transit authority, like a desk job, right?
Desk job, yeah. I worked for the CTA, an offshoot of the marketing department called Quality Management, which I always loved that name. Sounds like a real mob thing. Yeah, I work in quality management. Don't worry about it. But it was, I would do that during the day. And then at night, I was taking classes for a year, you know. This time in Chicago, by the way, you had so many, like, thousands of people were coming to Chicago to take part in this kind of, this movement kind of. And so I would take classes, and then I would start performing, and it was getting tough doing the desk job. And that, like, it's tough to go and do a show at, like, 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
Afterwards, everyone's drinking beers, hanging out. Getting up at like 6 a.m., getting on the subway, getting there by like 7:30 was tough. There was a lot of naps. I kept getting busted for napping. So it was definitely, it was fun but tough.
What do you think it is about Chicago that was like this, you know, this fertile soil for all these improv troops? I mean, obviously there was improv in New York and LA, which you would expect, right? You would expect LA to be the center of improv, and New York too, because of the theater scene there. But Chicago was a powerhouse. What explains that in your mind?
First of all, overall, I think Chicagoans have a very good sense of humor. I think they enjoy people making fun of people, and they love people making fun of them. Like, they love to be, like, they love it. They just thick skin, they just love it.
Yeah.
I think probably, though, the reason it ended up being a bit of an epicenter is probably just because of Second City. I feel like if you know, Bernie Sollins and those guys and Joyce in whenever, 1965, whatever, were like, what if we just did this in Kansas City? I imagine Kansas City might be a bigger hub. But I think because they were there, and Second City became such a big part of Chicago. It was pretty organic, but it was fun. Oh my God. You go to the Annoyance Theater and just see like crazy renegade comedy shows. It was a very, very, very fun time. A lot of laughs.
I mean, and as you mentioned, this is like, you're seeing Tina Fey and Rachel Dratch and Jason Sudeikis and like Jordan Peele, like all these people who are legends now. Like, you just see them on stage.
Well, I was a busboy at Second City, and this is like in 90, 96, 97. And yeah, Tina Fey and Rachel Dratch were both on the main stage. And then in the other theater, it was Brian Stack and Jerry Minor and Neil Flynn and Miriam Tolan and like Horatio. It was just like so many. And then like Chris Farley would come to see his brother do the Turco show and he would do the improv set and Mike Myers would be in town. It was just, it was crazy. And then I was kind of part of that, I don't know, maybe second or third wave where it was kind of guys coming in like Sudeikis. I remember the first day he showed up and Jack McBrayer and Seth Meyers and Liz Kukowski, just a lot of just amazingly funny people. A lot of whom we all still work together these days.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
So when you start taking classes, right?
Yeah.
How was it? I mean, this is a skill. Like it's like improv is, it's a skill, but also you have to like really work at it because it like tests your brain. You've got to work and think quickly. So how did you, like, what do you remember about just starting out?
I remember those early classes. I remember being not good at first. I remember being every character every time I would get into a scene, just kind of like aggro, kind of like not frat boy, but just kind of like, you know, the authority figure. And there's a phrase called, oh, you're in your head. On stage, I was in my head. I wasn't present with the moment and stuff. And I found I was really kind of, oh, I was funny. I got a laugh from the teacher or the class. I would have other moments where I'm on stage thinking too much.
Yeah.
And it really was kind of, I think, like when I went to the Annoyance Theater, there's a guy named Mick Napier who ran that theater. And his whole thing was just like embracing your failure and reveling in your failure, almost like you're going to fail a lot when you do this. And the only way to do it is not think about it so much. And a couple months with him really got me out of my head. And I remember when I first got, you know, you would take classes for a while. And then when they deemed you were socially acceptable to present to an audience, they would put you on some kind of group. Yeah, and I remember getting put on a team, and I remember inviting like my parents and a bunch of my friends who were in town, and like probably 30, 40 people came to this first show that I did, and it was really bad. It was just like bad. It was not funny and sweaty and blue and just not pleasant, and I was not great. And I remember afterwards like seeing some of them being a little worried, a little bit, not worried, not openly, just like being overly nice about the show.
Yep.
You know, yeah, it was crazy. You guys were all standing in line back there. So cool. And, you know, I wasn't like worried. I was bummed, wasn't worried. But then maybe two shows later, I had a couple friends come back and I had first really good show where I had a good response. I was connecting with the audience. Mm. And once you have that feeling, that's it. You just want to keep doing that. You want to chase that money. You know what I mean? You just want to just feel that feeling constantly.
How did you develop? I mean, it's a long slog, right? To get to a point where finally they're comfortable with you on the stage and you have to get comfortable with that. Do you remember how long it took from the time you started taking classes until the time you were actually performing in front of people in an audience?
I would say it was probably 6 months before I took my first class and the time we started doing shows.
Yeah.
And I would say the first 6 months of shows, with a couple exceptions here and there, I wasn't completely ready. Like you have to eat S a lot. You know what I mean? You gotta just really get humble and go through scenes where you just don't get laughs to know what it feels like. You got to bomb a little bit. And I just remember being grouped with a couple of people who I really responded to. And probably a year and a half in is when I started getting really comfortable. When I started kind of, you know, not stressing before the show. And from that point on, I really started developing, I think, as a player. And then they started asking me to do the big, you know, Monday night shows. And then the thing is if you like it and you've learned how to do it and you do it a lot, like you're going to get good. You know what I mean? You're going to start getting more and more confidence.
Yeah, I mean, it's like any kind of exercise, right? Like the more you're doing it, you're just going to get better and better at it, and over time, it probably became just easier for you to say funny things without even thinking about them.
Yeah, I just it's having the confidence to know that if you bomb, so what? I think that's what it is. I don't think there's anyone in comedy who just is like, I've always killed. It's just weird. I've just, from my first joke, I think you just have to know that, and to know that failure is not like the end of the world. If you're failing nonstop and you're never getting laughs and you're not happy, then yeah, that is a different thing. But just having a bad show, not connecting with an audience, is something that's going to happen to everyone, and it will make you grow. It will.
When we come back in just a moment, Ike decides to test his luck and move to LA to make it in comedy. And it doesn't really go as planned, at least at first. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to The Great Creators.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used, because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Hey, welcome back to The Great Creators. Let's pick up my conversation with Ike Barinholtz. You decide to move to LA. You're 23. This is 2000.
Yep.
Obviously, because this is where now you've got some experience under your belt, and this is where you have to go to pursue a career in film and television. When you got there, I mean, how did you start? I mean, how did you even – did you get an agent? Did you start to go on every audition possible? Like, you know, you're 23 in LA. Like, what do you do?
I'm 23 in LA. You've seen the show Entourage, right? It was just basically mm-hmm. like that. Just any episode of Entourage was what I was living at that time. No, I moved out here. I had left Chicago, and I did 2 years at this theater in Amsterdam called Boom Chicago, which was like a second city in Amsterdam, which was like rock and roll. You know what I mean? It was like you're doing a show every night in front of hundreds of people, and it's like a big deal, and you're almost like a celebrity. You're like a known comedy person in Amsterdam, and great people like Seth Meyers, his brother, Sudeikis, Jordan Peele, all those people. So that was this incredible environment where you were nurtured and loved and everyone was great. Then you come to LA and it's just like nothing. It's just nothing. Like nothing. I moved out with a couple friends and we had a really bad apartment and zero money. Like I'm talking like, you know, $8 in the checking account. Couldn't even get like a job, like washing dishes at first, you know? So the thought when I first got here, it was just like, oh yeah, an agent is just a million miles away. I remember I did get an audition for Quiznos to be an onion on one of their subs. You know Quiznos,
okay,
right?
Nice. Yeah, sure.
You remember they oven toasted their subs. That's like, that was their big thing.
Oven toasted sandwiches.
And they had a commercial that wanted actors to portray various vegetables and meats and cheeses.
Like Fruit of the Loom.
Like underwear. Fruit of the Loom, exactly.
But for sandwiches.
But the sandwiches. And then the twist, of course, is once the sandwiches start cooking, you have to start dancing and screaming and doing all kinds of funny stuff. And I auditioned for this, and I got a call back, and I was very excited. And then they went a different direction, and that was my one audition that year. And so that was
that year.
That was a rough one. That was a rough first year here.
Wow.
Yeah, I still think about it a lot, and I just think I could have really brought something special to that.
To the Onion.
To the Onion. I had. Yeah, whatever. It's fine. I'm over it. It's fine. But yeah, it was tough. It was tough at first. Luckily, I had like my little support network of friends, and we were, you know, going to each other's improv shows and one man shows, and it was around that time when Josh Myers, who's the brother of Seth Myers, kind of said, "Hey, we should do like a show together, a two man show." And so we did like a show, like a little sketch show together, and
yeah.
Our friend Nicole Sullivan was on Mad TV, and she told the producers they should see this, and they saw it. And then we got to audition for Mad TV. But that was after like a year. That was after a year and a half of being a busboy and like just nothing going on and just really being like,
yeah.
Did I make the right decision?
And during that year and a half, but it sounds like, I mean, you were still productive. I mean, you were writing sketch comedy, you were writing your own shows. Even if you only had an audience of five, you were still writing stuff and doing stuff.
Yes. I have a lot of friends who ask me, hey, they ask for advice. They're moving to LA. And what's the advice? And I think the only advice I can give people is just like, don't be passive. Don't just sit and wait. Even if you're just an actor and that's all you do, you're a brilliant actor. Don't just be like, someone needs to cast me. You know what I mean? Like, show them why. Make a video. You know what I mean? Write a play. Write a monologue. Do something. It will help you with your craft, but it will also get eyes on you. Someone can possibly see you. You know, otherwise you're just sitting and waiting. So that's, after a little while of just sitting and waiting and being like, nothing's happening. No one is calling. Writing with my friends and putting this show on and trying to get a little creative definitely saved us, like 100%. Otherwise, who knows? Like, if we never wrote the show, they would never come see it. We'd never get casted on Mad TV. And then it's like, who knows?
When you got that job on Mad TV, I mean, that's pretty significant. I mean, you were, you know, young, and it was a show that had an audience. That's a big deal, right? I mean, that was a huge break for you.
Yeah, I was over the moon, you know. I had always wanted to be on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
And I was hoping to kind of, you know, every year SNL has like a big batch of auditions, and I was like, oh, I'll audition for SNL this year. But Mad TV kind of called, and so exciting at first. Like, first of all, like to go from, you know, bussing tables to like being on a TV show is just like,
yeah,
lotto winner. And it was fun. I got to see how a TV show is made. I had no idea. Like, I didn't know what a mark was when I got there. I had nothing. And, you know, we had a great creative people in that show, fantastic writers, some phenomenal cast members. And they were pretty generous, I think, letting me write and bring them ideas. And, hey, what if we know we do this sketch? They were just very nice about it. And so I was thrilled. Like, it was very, very, very cool. I was making late night TV money, which meant I could like afford a blazer. You know what I mean? And like,
right.
I could go to dinner and not have to like check my bank account before I went. So it was pretty nice. And yeah, then eventually, like later years into it, I started getting a little restless.
When you were on Mad TV, there were some characters that you played and sketches that you were part of that were fans of the show know really well, like the Abercrombie models,
yes.
Or the gay straight guys. That was a famous one. I think you did that with Josh Myers.
Yes.
Right?
A football thing, yes.
I mean, obviously, there was a team of writers and performers, but it's all mixed. Everyone's involved in everything. And so tell me about some of those characters. You know, how did you think about making them come alive? And were you able to write some of those, you know, their lines and some of those characters?
Yeah, you know, it was just like you said, everyone was kind of doing everything there.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of times where you would just sit in a writer's office and just a riff ends up in the table read and that ends up getting picked. a football thing, which is the sketch with Josh and I, which apparently, like, every gay friend of mine is like, you should know that I have been to a gay club at some point, and that sketch has been playing on the television. It is like a very, it's one of my great joys in my life.
Yeah.
That was a sketch that the writers Brian Adams and John Crane performed at the Groundlings. And I remember they came to us and they were like, or maybe it wasn't John or Brian Adams, and I can't remember who, Mike maybe. And so this is a sketch we did. This was like our big killer sketch at the Groundlings, and we would like to give it to you guys. So that was like a big honor. Like,
and it's two like kind of macho, big American corn-fed guys watching football, but who would also make out during the football games.
Yeah, it's two bros watching a Tampa Bay Bucks game, and after a great play, they just have a full-on makeout session. And they're like, whoa, that was weird. Oh, look, the game's on. Yeah, yeah. And then it just, they can't stop. So yeah, when they gave it to Josh and I, you know, obviously zero trepidation, but it was just, we were so honored that they would give us this sketch that they probably performed, you know, 200 times at the Groundlings and brought the house down, and they gave it to us. But then there were things like the Abercrombie, which was just like, I think maybe Scott King, I can't remember who wrote it, Mike Hitchcock maybe, just them being just absolute weirdos and correctly identifying that the Abercrombie marketing campaign was, you know, very homoerotic. And
it was all white guys.
It was all white guys with like iron, flat ironed hair, and like they would always be wearing like corduroy pants that, with no shirt and like a scarf. I remember they asked me to do it, and I they were like, you're going to be shirtless. And I was like, that's cool. I have a very hairy chest, Ashkenazi Jewish. And they were like, do you mind waxing it? And I went and I got my chest waxed like Steve Carell in The 40-Year-Old Virgin. And it was a huge bummer. But I remember they were like, we're going to paint abs on you. And I was like, oh, great. And they painted them on, but it didn't work because like it would jiggle. Like, you know what I mean? Like if you just paint abs on, if you take a still photo, maybe, but like any movement, you're like, oh, okay, this guy's just got makeup on his stomach. But it was, it took off. And I guess there was a documentary about Abercrombie and Fitch that came out last year. And that they
there is a very good one. And there are scenes from, yes.
God, so funny. Yep. But it was, it really was they were very open to, whether it was a sketch that Josh Myers and I did in our two-man show that they bought from us, or sitting in an office with like Stephen Craig and Jennifer Joyce, or just, having them give you one of their old sketches. I was really lucky to be with like really, really nice people. You know, the writers were so nice, and the cast was just, I'm still friends with a lot of them today. It was a fun gig for a young guy.
You were there for 5 years.
Yes.
And in 2007, you decide to leave, and it was I think it was a tough time for you. What happened? What was the spark that?
Well, you know
that got you.
It's funny. I the decision to leave was not mine. It was my contract was up, and I was. It's so funny. I remember being very hopeful that I would get like a good raise. I remember saying to my wife, my girlfriend at the time, like, you know, there's a new deal, like. Like, I'm going to want a lot of money. And, you know, then I remember we went on a trip somewhere and I got the call that they were not re-signing me to a new contract. So it's really one of those moments where you're like, you tell someone this is how much you want and their counter offer is zero. And you're like, So I was pretty bummed for a minute, but I think generally optimistic guy. And this is, you know, what is this, 2007 maybe or so. And this was the normal thing that happened was when you ended on a TV show, you would go and do a pilot. Because everyone was doing pilots. We had so many pilots. Oh, my Lord, everyone was doing a pilot. Pilot season, so many shows. And so I was, you know, I'll just get a pilot somewhere. And I kind of entered this like 3+ year period where I got nothing. Very little. Like, I mean, nothing that I was really excited about, nothing that people were loving or even seeing, just tiny gigs to give me just enough money to pay rent over the course of the next 3 years. And of course, now I'm out here with this woman who I have asked to move to Los Angeles with me, and she moved out to live with a TV guy, and now he's just like a struggling actor. So it was pretty rough. It was a pretty rough time post Mad TV.
Yeah, I read you tested for like more than 20 roles of 25 different shows and nothing. I mean, what do you think was going on? I mean, why? What was your theory about that?
Well, one theory is I wasn't maybe good. Like, I wasn't like the performer I am now. I was coming off Mad TV. I wasn't like, maybe that's part of it. Definitely a part of it was, I think at that time, the majority of comedies were not casting guys like me. I like, this is right before you started getting what I think was kind of like the last golden age of network TV comedy, which is like around The Office and 30 Rock and of the like. And before that, the sitcom guys that were getting roles, I think, were more just like kind of like just conventionally hot guys, like model-y kind of dudes. Oh, we're nice guys. I know some of them. But like, I would get to that last level. And I also thought one time too, I was pretty convinced it was because of my teeth. I had a very prominent front two teeth with a bit of a gap, which now is very trendy according to the internet. But I do think there was just kind of this standard look that dudes had in sitcoms from like 2000 to 2006. That was just not quite me. It just wasn't, it was a huge bummer. It was a huge bummer. And there was definitely moments then when I was like, I'm a little worried. Like, I just don't know like what does the future hold? What am I going to be? Yeah. And I luckily kind of, my writing partner has been my best friend, Dave Stassen, for like
Dave Stassen,
30 plus
who you've known
years.
Since high school, I think, or since
no, we went to like day camp together, like Rams Club Sport Camp. When we were like 10.
Wow.
And we had moved out here together, and we were going to write, and then I got Mad TV, and then he went to DC to work on Pardon the Interruption, amazing show. Mm-hmm. And during that time, I remember we were just talking a lot, and it was like, he's like, maybe I'll come back there. And I was like, yeah, we should just write. Like, we can be a writing team. Let's just do it. We're just going to write. And so he had come back, and it was again, like, I fall back on that advice I always tell people is do something when you're here, whatever, just do something. And so because I wasn't getting cast in anything, we would spend all day writing. We're going to like, I have an idea for a movie, and we would text each other all night that, well, this happens. And then just spend 2 weeks just being like, let's write this movie. And we loved it. It was so much fun. And even though we did not have a lot of success with it at first, it felt like movement. It felt like growth. It felt like we were doing something. And it was definitely the key to everything, 100%.
When we come back after a quick break, Ike's venture into screenwriting pays off, landing him an invitation to work as a writer and eventually an actor on Mindy Kaling's The Mindy Project. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to The Great Creators.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, welcome back to The Great Creators. So it's the mid-2000s, and Ike Barinholtz has just been let go by Mad TV. And no matter how hard he tried to land another role, nothing was happening. So he and his writing partner, Dave Stassen, just started cranking out their own ideas. One of the scripts you guys wrote, which was not made but sounds funny, was about three stoners who decided to kill Osama bin Laden.
Let's get Osama, baby. Still, we could still make it today. I don't see what's preventing us from making it.
And so you would sit down and you would literally write these scripts for a film.
Yes. I think like the most exciting thing in showbiz to me is the feeling of having a great idea for whether it's a show, a series, or a movie or whatever, having a great idea and becoming obsessed with it for like 2 to 3 nights where you're thinking about it all day, nonstop. You start writing it and it's just pouring out of you. That is like the most fun part. And I've got to do that a lot. Most of them have not sold, but like that feeling is like more exhilarating, I think, than stepping onto a stage. More exhilarating than wrapping a movie. Just that feeling of just like, oh my God, I'm just pouring out of my brain is very, very, I love it. I love that.
And it seems like even though you weren't finding a whole lot of success, you and Dave weren't at the time, I mean, eventually you would. Like you wrote and starred and directed a film called The Oath that was your work. And so that probably couldn't have happened if that period didn't happen earlier in your career.
100%. By us like basically recommitting to it and spending hours and hours and hours writing Let's Get Osama, writing, you know, these other movies that didn't get sold, eventually one day, and maybe a year and a half in, we sold one. We sold Central Intelligence, which ended up becoming a real movie with Dwayne Johnson and Kevin Hart. And from that moment on, we were like, okay, we are writers now. That's it. Writers first. And it was, I think, because of that, we got access to the next level, right? You sell a movie and you've passed the he's not crazy test because they've given you money and you've delivered a product and it's been fine. Then you get access to the next level, which is like, oh, wow, we're going to be able to maybe sell a pitch or take someone else's pitch and write it and stuff. And just by spending, you know, another couple years doing that and really just writing and writing and writing and writing, when the time came to get a job with Mindy Kaling as writers, we were like ready to go. And, and it was, that was, I think, the next thing that kind of as a writer got us to the next access to the next level.
Yeah, because when you were brought onto that show, The Mini Project, I mean, initially, you guys were brought on as writers, right? You and Dave.
Yes. Yeah, they...
And I guess your role was to be there from, like, to be on set all day and to rewrite and write, like, bits on set.
Yeah, they hired us as writers together. I think story editors is what our title was. Mm-hmm. We spent those first 3-4 months in the writer's room with all like hardcore TV writers like Mindy Kaling, you know, and like Matt Warburton, who was basically running The Simpsons, and like a lot of like Harvard folks who have just been SNL writers for years, just like people who have spent hundreds of, if not thousands of hours in a room. And we loved it. Like we really, really learned a lot watching like the Mindy Kaling system, which is kind of like a version of the Greg Daniels system of story breaking and season breaking and character breaking, and kind of seeing how they do that. And kind of, that's just so much fun being in a room with a bunch of other funny people pitching funny bits. So much fun. And, you know, around that time, Mindy, she early on was like, oh, you should be on the show because you're a funny actor. And I thought I would end up being like a guy who shows up every 3 or 4 episodes, like a janitor or something. Right. And then one day she kind of handed me this monologue for Morgan and was like, if you read this and you like it, we should just go and put you on tape. And we told the network you're doing it, but we just want to put you on tape and show them. And so I finally passed the network test because of Mindy, because Mindy was like, you have to hire him. And by me being on set a little bit, and you know, part of their theory is when you write an episode of TV, it's not like you just write it and hand it to the showrunner and you start the next episode. Like, they want you to produce that episode. They want you to, you know, write it by yourself, then come in with a room and rewrite it, and help lead the rewrite, and go to the production meetings and be on set. And I just think because Dave and I are like, whatever, affable Midwest guys who are comfortable around, like, you know, crew. And there's two of us. She thought it would be helpful to the show for us to be on kind of the onset writers for the next 6 years, basically. And that was that was amazing, because that really gave me like the, I knew everything about running a TV show after that. Like, I just saw every possible thing.
Just working in that process, in that system that she set up.
You just learn, because you get all the writer's side of it. You get to see how the stories become stories and how they change and how you throw them out and start over. But being on the floor and seeing how like actual like TV is made was fascinating. It took me like, it just blew me away. And now, like I said, like when I go on to, like if you needed me, if I got a phone call, Abbott Elementary, the director's sick, can you come and direct? I could walk onto that set right tomorrow morning and just be like, got it. Just because we spent, you know, hundreds and hundreds of hours there, and just you know, I just think it's listening to people. It's knowing when to, you know, to lean on people and to trust, like, you know, the team leaders and stuff, and just communicating. Like, that was a big thing. Whenever there's a bad set, it's always just bad communication.
How did you know, and how do you know now when something is funny? I mean, you know, there's some sketches you know, I watch a lot of Mad TV, reading about you, and there's some sketches that just don't land. They're not that funny, right?
Yes.
And I imagine the threshold on the Mindy project was just in just much, much higher, just incomparably higher for what would be acceptable to the writers, right?
Yeah.
And so, like, how do you know when you're writing something and you're in a writer's room or you're working with other writers that it's good enough?
Comedy is the only type of genre where you can kind of instantly gauge if it's effective, right? If you're in the writer's room and I pitched a line for Mindy that just got a huge laugh, unless it really bumps the story, it's probably going to end up in the show. So you already got a pretty good idea that it made these, whatever, 12 people laugh. And then I think it's a pretty good gauge to the next level is the table read. You know, how does that play at the table read? How does that play on the floor? Are the crew members laughing? If the crew members are laughing, like, there's this great feeling you get sometimes where it's like you're almost worried the crew is going to mess up the take because they're laughing, but you know they won't because they're a good crew, which is like the best feeling, because like, you know, it is funny. Now, there have been times where all those three hurdles have happened and they've been funny, and then it doesn't necessarily look great on TV, but that's, who cares?
Yeah.
But I think you do just get this built-in barometer with comedy. And conversely, it's just like, if a bit is dying, if it's a bit that no one laughs at, but for some reason you need to get it in story, and table read doesn't get a laugh, but you still keep it in and it makes it all the way to the episode, it will probably be bad in the episode. You know what I mean? Maybe it still serves a purpose, but that's the thing. You just don't get that with drama. You know, it's not like someone like in a drama room pitches like a line and everyone's like, oh, that was really dramatic. You know what I mean? Like, it's, I think you just, with comedy, you can just gauge from people's instant reactions.
You mentioned like being part of that show, like having worked as a writer for a few years and having some success, but not as much as you'd hope, but then getting on the Mindy project and learning all the aspects of how everything works. Presumably, you couldn't have written and directed and starred in your own film without that experience.
100% no. Like, it allowed me to, for the first time, even though I had been on Mad TV, it's a late night sketch show is a little bit different. Like, a late night sketch show is it's just its own thing. But to kind of just get to see how it works and be part of it. It was, and then also on, you know, every summer I would do a movie, right? I would go off and do whatever, Neighbors or Sisters or something. And it just gave me the confidence that I was like, oh yeah, I could write and direct a movie. Like I can do that. And so, yeah, without the Mindy of it all, like nothing else happens. There's no, The Oath, there's no whatever history of the world. There's just me as a guy who's in a writer's room that you're like, was he on Mad TV?
Tell me about, I mean, one of the greatest comedy films, certainly of all times up there, certainly the top 50, Mel Brooks, History of the World, Part 1.
Oh, yes.
You are in History of the World, Part 2. Mel Brooks involved with that, of course. Nick Kroll and others are in that. I think one of the characters you play for sure is Leon Trotsky.
Yes.
Did you have any interaction or much interaction with Mel Brooks?
Yeah, this is, a year and a half ago probably. Dave Stassen and I were kind of in between a couple different things, and Nick Kroll, who's I've known for a long time, he reached out and said, hey, you know, we are trying to figure this out. You know, it's Mel, it's History of the World Part 2, it's me, it's Wanda. And I've seen that movie 100 times. Like, I've seen it so much. And when he called us, like, Dave and I right away got very, very excited because we saw, like, the possibilities of what a show could be.
Yeah.
And I'm a history fanatic. Like all I read about, it's every podcast I listen to. I'm obsessed with history. And so we spent a long time with Nick and Wanda kind of breaking the show. But the first thing we needed was approval from Mel. And, you know, the thought of even like meeting Mel Brooks in my life is like, you know, dream of dreams, won't happen. Now we have to meet him and he has to like us. You know what I mean? So I remember we went on, like, we met him on a Zoom because obviously it's COVID and we didn't want to, you know, go to his house and rattle him. And then, you know, every few weeks we would check in with Mel and, you know, pitch him kind of, hey, we want to do the Russian Revolution. And we kind of think it would be, you know, like this. And God bless him, like, could not be more supportive. Definitely had like his bunch of jokes. He was like, you got to make sure when Robert E. Lee, when he shows up and his men are there, I want this joke. And so he was very hands-on as much as he could be, which was just like incredible. Like the 96-year-old man giving you like comedy pitches that are hilarious. It was an absolute dream come true. And I hope people like it.
Tell me about, you've done all these different projects, you know, just talked about a fraction of them, but you've written and directed and started a feature and you've got this, you know, prolific career as an actor. Tell me what are some of the things that you want to do? I mean, do you want to do another film, writing and directing, or, you know?
Yeah, I definitely think so. Directing a movie is incredibly, it's very exhilarating and rewarding, but it is just, it takes over your life. When you're directing a movie, it's the only thing you could do, really. And it's not like, you know, it's a 6-week shoot. Okay, you're done then. It's like it's like 6 months of your life. But I did love it. I really loved making a small little movie where you really have kind of complete creative control. You know, that's just something you don't really get a lot on TV, and you don't want a lot on TV because it's such a big thing you're working on that you want lots of points of views and stuff. But on a movie, it's just like, it's, this is what's in your head, and you get it whatever way you want to do it, you get to do it. So yeah, I wrote a film that maybe next year I'll shoot. You know, in terms of what do I want to do? I keep finding myself, and just, I'm so lucky. I keep finding myself in these positions where I keep kind of checking off these boxes. Like a couple years ago, if you had said, oh, you'll work a bunch with Norman Lear and know him, I'd be like, what? No. And then I've gotten to do a couple of these All in the Families with him and come and have him give me, you know, direction. And it's just same thing with Mel. And so I just kind of, I want to just keep working and telling funny stories, cool stories. And showbiz is different now, right? It used to be like if you're on a TV show, you're doing 22 episodes of that TV show, and that's basically all you're going to do. And Everything's changed now. It's all different, you know. So if you do a TV series, you go and you do 10 episodes of it. Maybe you shoot it all in a couple months. Then maybe you go and then you're writing on a TV show that you're not maybe necessarily acting in. And then You go and you're prepping to do your movie. If I can always just be kind of jumping into one of these things, I would be very, very, very happy. I just cannot emphasize how lucky I have been. And I just hope that luck never runs out.
That's actor, comedian, screenwriter, and director Ike Barinholtz. By the way, History of the World Part 2 is now out. You can find it streaming on Hulu. We'll link to some of Ike's greatest Mad TV sketches and clips from his films in the show notes at thegreatcreators.com/Barinholtz. We publish show notes for all of our episodes at thegreatcreators.com. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Great Creators early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. Hey, thanks so much for listening to our show this week. Please do follow us however or wherever you're listening to this so you never miss a new episode. This episode was produced by Nat Hoops and edited by Jeff Rogers. Thanks also to Kevin Leahy, Michael May, Elaine Coates, Jenna Gedman, and Daniel Shugan. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to The Great Creators from Built It Productions. Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that saved Abercrombie, or which real tech acquisition is like Game of Thrones, or the one financial equation that can finally solve climate change? Then check out the Daily News podcast, The Best One Yet. Every morning on The Best One Yet, hosts Nick and Jack serve up to three of the most interesting business news stories and why you need to know them in just 20 minutes. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies, you're going for that promotion at work, or you just want to know the trends before your friends, be in the know this year by starting your morning with The Best One Yet every weekday. Follow The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free right now on Wondery Plus, and for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more. Wondery means business. Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you, like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. I'm Guy Raz, and on my show How I Built This, I talk to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt and failure and talk about how they were able to overcome them on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen to Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.